The Flying Dutchman by Washington Irving. Mynheer Vanderdecken stood on the bridge watching the men load his ship, the Amsterdammer. She was to sail at sunset, and there were only 2 more hours to go. Mynheer Vanderdecken leant on the rail of the bridge, pulled his pet bear's ear, and swore at 3 men who had dumped a barrel of wine on the deck, instead of lowering it at once by the slings into the hold. "We haven't got a week to load," he shouted. "Get on there. What are you doing? Do I pay you to stand about? And be careful of that cargo. You'll lose your wages if any cask is damaged. You know that. Come on now. What's Van Triel up to? Strike up there. They'll be all night loading without a tune. Something to keep them moving." The fiddler hastily began to play the song, "The Lass of Antwerp Town," and the feet of the dockers and the crew were soon moving briskly to the beat. Even the most surly members, Peter the cook, who stood 6 foot and 3 inches and weighed 15 stone, and Bergner the boatswain, who hated Captain Vanderdecken, could not help responding to the lively tune. The hold was rapidly filling, and the captain, seeing from the sun behind the many masts in the harbour that the time was about 5 o'clock, called the Bear, left the bridge, and stumped down to make a last inspection of the ship. He was a big man, and in shape and walk was very like his pet bear, although the animal was small. Both were heavy and awkward, with great shoulders and forward-thrust heads, small, suspicious eyes, thick, untidy hair, and a rolling walk with feet well apart to balance their ungainly bodies against the rolling of the ship. Those of the crew who had sailed under Vanderdecken before said that no one could decide which of the two was fouler-tempered. Klaus the Bear could not swear, but he growled horribly, and he drank whatever rum or schnapps or beer his master could spare him out of the bottle. Everyone feared Klaus when he was drunk, except Vanderdecken, and everyone feared Vanderdecken drunk or sober. He marched down the dark, narrow passage of the ship to the storerooms and the men's quarters. He was wearing a red nightcap with a round fur cap over it, for the March evening was chilly. A huge blue coat with silver buttons over a dirty yellow waistcoat, dirty red breeches and great leather boots. As he had been busy all day in the ship, he wore a canvas apron over everything, held up by a belt and buckle, on which a powerful curved knife was slung in a sheath, and from the other side hung an earthenware flat bottle of schnapps. His beard was rough and full of tobacco ash, his eyebrows so heavy that they seemed to hang over his eyes and obscure his vision. But his eyes were piercing, and missed no detail of the ship or the men. Though he was a fierce and lawless man, rough-tongued and hard-drinking, he was a first-class seaman and captain, and feared no weather and no enemy on sea or land. The Amsterdammer was a sailing ship of some 350 tons. She was built about 1630, and was now nearly 20 years old, very strong and seaworthy, and fast for her build. Her bottom was nearly flat, and her sides curved in above the water, so that her hold was twice as wide as her upper decks. This made her steady and gave more room for the living quarters than a casual observer would have expected from her size, though all below decks was dark, airless, and smelly with food, ship stores, cheese, tallow for candles and grease, rats and 45 men. Lanterns hung here, and they gave a flickering yellow light as Vanderdecken went by, followed by his hulking shadow, Klaus. When he reached the stores, which were stowed for ballast, as near the middle of the ship as possible, against the hold, he found Krantz, the ship's storekeeper and carpenter, busy amongst the barrels of salt pork, biscuit, and dried beans on which the whole ship's company would chiefly live on their year's voyage to the East Indies and back. Extra food and luxuries would be taken on at different ports, but these were the main standby of the ship, especially in the long weeks in southern seas or bad weather, when she might not see land or be able to get into port. The captain had already examined the condition of the food in the barrels, the quality of the ship's stores of rope, tallow, pitch, canvas, spare timber and the rest, and now had only to inspect their position and safe storage, and receive the lists already checked by Krantz. The thud and rumble of wine barrels being stowed in the hold came dully to their ears, and the faint pad-pad of bare feet of the crew.
"It'll be a fair trip," said Krantz,
who had often sailed with Vanderdecken before.
"The crew seem to know their business."
"They'll be all right if the weather doesn't keep us at sea too long. Last trip was all right till the scurvy got us."
They both grunted, for the recollection was a grim one. Storms and contrary winds had blown them out west of the Canary Islands for many weeks. Pork and beans were exhausted, biscuits were rationed by ounces, and even water ran low. All the crew fell sick of the terrible disease, and 16 died. Rats were caught in the ship and sold amongst the starving men for food, and only the captain's presence and his knife stood between the crew and Klaus the Bear, whose flesh was demanded daily. The men were too weak and ill to keep the ship in proper repair, and when at last she limped into Cape Verde Islands, her masts were rotting, her sails in rags, her sides leaking and below decks rotten and crawling with damp and filth. Fresh meat, onions, lemons, and all the other fresh provisions obtained in Cape Verde cured the men of the disease in a week, and after a month both they and the ship were fit to proceed on the voyage. Captain Vanderdecken had lost money over that misfortune through having to reprovision and refit the ship, and he had no desire for any repetition. Next to the stores was the powder for the guns, which the captain had already seen to most carefully. Arms for the men were under heavy bars in a small cabin, only accessible to Vanderdecken himself, leading off his own cabin, which was farthest aft in the ship. Calling Klaus the Bear away from an open drum of tallow, he stumped off down the dim passage again, forward to the drink supply on the other side of the hold. Here were great barrels of water and brandy, and in one partition the captain's own kegs of special quality liquor. To Vanderdecken, grog was more important than biscuit. He had barrels of sweet French wine, kegs of brandy, big stone jars of Dutch schnapps and cordials. Looking at them with satisfaction, he took a long pull at the bottle in his belt and passed it in silence to Krantz, who followed his example. As he replaced the bottle, Klaus sniffed and licked it and his hand. The captain returned on to the main deck. This carried 6 small guns, which had seen much service against pirates and hostile inhabitants along the coasts of the eastern seas. On the forecastle, another small deck rose high above the water, called the topgallant forecastle. Aft, the main deck was again broken by the poop, which rose to an equal height. From the main deck rose the foremast, mainmast, and mizzenmast. The captain shouted for the boatswain, who came at a run-up from the hold. He was a scarred and bearded fellow, of enormous strength, wearing a rough jersey, rolled-up moleskin breeches, no shoes, but a once-smart long red coat turned back in front with metal buttons to show his rank as immediate head of the crew. He reported that all was stored below, wine for shipment to a trading station in Java, crates of bright ornaments and metal objects for barter with the natives of the East, for precious stones, spices, gold, and fine silks. Vanderdecken gave orders for all who were not members of the crew to leave the vessel, for the sails to be set. He clambered up the poop ladder and joined his first mate, Minor Warburg, a short man of early middle age whose face was clean-shaven and showed a pleasant, almost mild, disposition. He was neatly dressed in brown and wore a wig and buckled shoes. Together they stood on the poop deck and watched the sailing preparations. The great harbour of Amsterdam was crowded with shipping, and the masts and sails rose from the ponderous hulks like housetops on the water. The Amsterdammer was anchored some way from shore and had been loading from a barge. As the gangways ran up on board, the ladies who had been returned to the barge in time had to leap from the Amsterdammer's decks amidst the shouts and jeers of the crew. The ship was filled with furious activity. While the boatswain shouted and cursed, the sailors hurried to and fro, running up the shrouds to the sails and working at full speed because of Van der Decken's watchful eye. If any were sad at leaving home on the long and perilous voyage, no sign appeared. The captain himself had left a wife and infant son behind, and Minor Warburg a wife and three children. No doubt, all of the 45 members of the crew had homes and love relations whom they might never see again, but this was no time for reflection. The sun was on the horizon, and the air was very chill, and a sharp sunset breeze had sprung up. The sails flopped down, shivered, and felt the wind. When all was ready, the boatswain looked to the captain. The order rang out, and the fiddler struck up the song for the weighing of the anchors. The whole crew took up the song, and so did the men on the other ships nearby. The sweet, half-plaintive tune swelled out and echoed against the sails and the water in the evening breeze, over an undersound of the rumble and rattle of the anchor's chains. The ships sail free, a gale is blowing, away ye rollin' rover. The Amsterdammer quivered as she obeyed the wind. The anchor came up with a run, and to the shouts of the nearby ships, she began to move. Away we're bound to go, across the stormy ocean.
File 2.
Troubles began on the very first night. It was almost as if the ship knew of her fate in advance, and was reluctant to pursue the dreadful voyage. That night a sharp gale caught her, and though the vessel herself was not damaged, Minor Warburg was flung down a ladder by a sudden pitch of the ship, and his thigh was broken. This meant that only Captain Van der Decken and the second mate, Minor Hilbrandt, were left as officers. Bergmar the boatswain thought even more now that he ought to be raised to the rank of an officer. He went among the men, sullenly that night, as the ship creaked and rolled her way towards the Atlantic, and cursed below his breath when the captain's name was mentioned. Warburg was strapped into his bunk and tended as well as possible, but he knew he had little hope of recovery. A sick man was a dead man on the ships of 1650. The gale continued and freshened still more as the Amsterdammer struggled round the shoulder of France down towards the Bay of Biscay. Van der Decken grew even more silent and morose and drained his bottle even more frequently as the weather, already bad for the time of year, grew worse. Winds tore at the rigging. Huge seas swept over the decks, smashing against the high forecastle and poop, so that the ship shuddered and reeled. Each day the sky was heavy and brown with racing clouds, and the light was so bad that even in the day the dimness and heavy spray made it impossible to see ahead. The sailors huddled together, unable to keep any corner of the ship dry, and went sullenly about their work, so that Van der Decken ordered extra wine and brandy to be served for fear of losing men through chills and fevers. Minor Warburg grew no worse, but his sufferings and his patience only angered the captain. Van der Decken was particularly enraged when he found Warburg reading the Bible. Then he would curse and drink more wildly than before, and tell Warburg that he would give the book to Klaus to tear in pieces. This was the only threat that could move Warburg to anger, and he feared that in a mad moment, Van der Decken might carry it out. Conditions improved as the Amsterdammer proceeded south. She put in at the little ports down the coast of France and sailed up the great Garonne to the fine city of Bordeaux. Here she was able to repair her damages and replenish her food and wine stores. Here the crew thoroughly cleaned the ship, smoking her out below decks to rid her of vermin, and washed her down throughout with vinegar to sweeten her and keep down the diseases brought by rats and vermin. Then they sailed on, and rounding the wild north coast of Spain, they turned south. Off Portugal they had to stand out to sea at times to avoid the Moorish pirates who hovered round some districts. Van der Decken was too good a sailor to engage in unnecessary or hopeless combats. If unmolested, they would put into some quiet harbour where hills covered with vines and orange and lemon groves ran down to the water, and half-naked brown-skinned peasants with bright headdresses would row out in little boats piled high with fruit, shouting and singing in the strange tongues of Portugal and Spain. Van der Decken would bargain by holding up so many fingers and shouting unintelligibly in Dutch. If the peasants refused, half a dozen men from the Amsterdammer would be ready in the ship's boat to seize the provisions, whether the peasants agreed or not. Wine was plentiful, and the ship's company drank heavily. So Europe was left behind, and the ship set out for the Canary Islands, Madeira, and the little-known rich coast of Africa. The weather was unreliable. Storms came out suddenly, or else fog settled over the sea from some warm island nearby. The ship lost her mizzenmast before reaching Madeira, but was able to replace it from the woods there. But sometimes the weather was good, and the ship sped easily on to her fate. On warm starry nights, the men would lie on deck, singing rough songs with the fiddler and teasing Klaus the bear. The ship's mast tops and rigging moved evenly to and fro across the stars. The sails held the wind with a humming sound, and an occasional creak and flap and bang. But the spirit of the crew was low, and even their songs seemed melancholy. The captain pacing on a fine night on the poop deck was moved to exasperation, and leaning over the rail to where the men lay playing cards round a lantern and singing, he bellowed, "Are you a pack of sick cats down there? Has the drink turned sour on you? Yowling and caterwauling? Strike up a lively tune, or I'll have the skins off you." They cursed him under their breath, and did as he ordered. So the weeks passed until the Amsterdammer was far in the South Atlantic, and the weather was blowing up for the dreaded rounding of the Cape of Good Hope. Under Bergmar's command, the men had become very unruly. There had been several floggings, and only threats of chains and hanging kept order in the ship. The steadying influence of Warburg was missed, and the captain had taken to carrying two heavy pistols in his belt, as well as his knife and bottle. There had been much sickness on the voyage and many accidents, and Van der Decken knew in his heart that it would be wiser to put into port and lie up for a fortnight before braving the fearful storms off the Cape, when he might lose half his crew. But he feared the temper of the men, who might easily refuse to put to sea again after a fortnight of ease. Also, his own temper and irritation had grown so bad that even his good seaman's sense was clouded, and almost any reasonable suggestion appeared to him as laziness or cowardice. Anything Warburg said threw him into a passion, although the unhappy man was now very ill and clearly could not recover. So the Amsterdammer entered on the last fatal stage. The danger region of the southernmost latitude around the Cape is 1,500 miles. 1,500 miles before the terrors of that fearful sea are left behind. 1,500 miles. 10 days' journey in perfect weather and perfect sailing conditions for a small ship. Anything from 40 to 100 days for a ship like the Amsterdammer in heavy adverse gales. 6 or 7 weeks of sleepless, drenched existence for the crew, struggling with the icy tackle, living on biscuit and raw salt meat when the cook's fires were doused by heavy seas, numbed and exhausted from one weary day to another. This was the Amsterdammer state for 5 weeks. There was no time or strength for mutiny, nothing but the unremitting struggle to keep the heavy ship on her course and avoid being dashed upon the savage coast or blown out into the unknown ocean south of her passage. Day and night was hardly distinguishable, so heavy was the flying spray between the dazed faces of the crew and the lowering skies. Day and night the huge seas thundered in their ears and drenched their bodies. Each man laboured for 16 or 20 hours out of the 24, and flung himself into an exhausted slumber whenever he was released from toil. Human nature and human strength could not endure it for ever. Members of the crew besought Van der Decken repeatedly to turn back and put into the haven of Table Bay, but he only cursed them and drank more deeply from his bottle. But it could not go on. One wild night the dying miner Warburg besought three of the crew to carry him up to the captain, where he struggled with the wheel. Warburg knew that he was dying, and believed that so desperate an effort to plead with the captain might save the ship. As soon as he set eyes on Van der Decken's fierce and drink-inflamed face, he knew it was hopeless. But he made the attempt. He called on the captain to think of his wife and child, of all the anxious homes in the distant Low Countries, where wives and mothers would never see their husbands and sons again if this mad course were continued. Van der Decken only shouted him down above the wind and clung more furiously to the wheel. Then Warburg called on him as a seaman, as master of a good ship, to quit this foolhardy attempt and wait for better weather. Van der Decken's face became suffused with passion. Shouting to Bergmar to take the wheel, he rushed violently upon the helpless Warburg, and to the horror of the onlookers, seized him and flung him overboard. In an instant, the wretched man had disappeared in the boiling sea. Van der Decken snatched out a pistol and rounded on the men who retreated in terror of the frenzied, raging captain. Raising a fist to heaven, he shouted, "I swear by God, I will round this cape, no matter what the weather, if I beat about it till Judgment Day." On the words, a terrific crack of thunder immediately overhead seemed to split the ship. Sky and sea and deck blazed for a second in a vivid flash of lightning. Each man was rooted to the spot in terror. To Van der Decken's dazed eyes, it was as if his oath were written in lightning on the wild dark air itself. A shriek of horror came from the men, whose starting eyes and stricken faces made him whirl round to follow their gaze. Behind him, on the rail or on the deck, was a ghastly cloud of phosphorescent light. As he gazed, even his fierce heart appalled. The shape of it seemed to darken into something of a human shape. Van der Decken gripped his pistol and fired at it. Immediately he screamed and clapped his left hand to his right arm. The bullet had turned from the apparition and wounded Van der Decken himself. There was another crash of thunder, blinding lightning, and the Amsterdammer, her captain, and her crew vanished into the darkness of eternity.
File 3.
No news had reached the wife of Van der Decken for many weeks. All she had heard was rumour from returning ships of unequalled bad weather around the Cape, and her heart was full of fears. One night she heard a window slam and got up to fasten it. The baby whimpered in his sleep, and she hastened to stop the disturbing sound. As she opened the door of the room where the window had banged, a gust of wind blew out her candle, and suddenly she was seized with an icy fear. A shadowy form stood between her and the window, and the room was unnaturally cold. As she stood frozen with horror, her husband's voice said, "Catherine!" Immediately fear was forgotten, for the joy of belief that he had come unexpectedly home and arrived thus in the dark. She ran to embrace him and found him standing very still, dripping water and emanating an icy atmosphere. "Catherine," he repeated in sombre tones, quite unlike his usual voice. "Listen, my time is short. I am indeed your husband, but neither alive nor dead." She started in horror, and he told her briefly of the storm, his frenzy, his murder of Warburg, and his blasphemous oath on the name of God. "That oath has been heard. I swore by God, and he is witness to it, and will see that it is fulfilled. This moment is spared me to tell you. I return now to beat about the Cape, neither dead nor alive, till Judgment Day." His voice rose to a dreadful moan. "Pray for me, condemned to a living death, compelled to drink as I did in life, yet all I swallow turning me to molten iron and gall, bringing disaster to any ship to whose sight we appear, the perpetual curse and warning of the sea. Pray for me, that the curse may be lifted on that day, and not perpetuated in eternity." The dark figure vanished, and his widow wife fell senseless to the floor. The United British Fruit Line steamer, Pride of Westminster, was on her usual route from London to Cape Town, Madagascar, and up to Colombo. She was a sturdy vessel of some 1,000 tons, driven by oil-fed reciprocating engines, and had been in commission 8 years. For the past 2 years, she had been under Captain Johnson, and some curious rumours had begun to arise about the use he made of this regular voyage. The Pride only put in at the usual ports up the east coast of Africa, and nothing could be said openly against her captain. But sometimes she stayed extra time in port, and the captain went on inland journeys, which he did not explain. One fine evening a group of men were on deck, gossiping about the captain. The chief engineer MacDonald said boldly,
"It's either pearls or drugs. Because of the bulk, if it were gold, he'd have to carry chests, but pearls or dope could go in his pocket."
"Well, how does he do it? He's never got any money that I ever saw. I know how his wife lives, like a real lady."
"I always thought that he must have got in debt and be trying to pay it off, the way she has to live,"
said the second mate Denham.
"Not he, but he spends it all gambling, I guess. And it's the company's money that starts these little ventures of his."
Ferguson, the cook, came out of the galley wiping the sweat off his forehead and rubbing his hands on his dirty overall.
"I'd like to know what his ventures are, I must say," went on MacDonald.
I wouldn't put the slave trade past him if he had the opportunity.
He's a bad man, said Ferguson, taking out his pipe and spitting into the sea.
He's a bad man, and we'll be lucky if he doesn't bring us all to a bad end one day.
The others smiled, and MacDonald said,
You're a superstitious old fellow, Cook. You'll believe the wildest yarn.
Denham answered for him.
The wildest yarn may be true at sea. I wouldn't refuse to believe anything just because it sounded impossible. I used to be like that when I was younger, but now I don't know. I wouldn't be too sure.
He was a man of about 45, who had originally come from Western Australia and had wandered around the world in many different jobs until he finally took to the sea at 25.
Oh, come on, said MacDonald. Don't tell me you've seen the Flying Dutchman or a mermaid or something.
Well, I haven't. I haven't seen enough to make me think I might see it either.
Ferguson grunted at this and spat again.
Well, no one denies that sea serpents and monsters exist, and you might think you'd seen a mermaid if you'd tried hard enough. But the Flying Dutchman is a bit of a tall order, unless you mistook a cloud or a bunch of palms on one of your enchanted islands for her.
MacDonald was Scottish and believed in nothing but himself and his engines.
I didn't say I'd seen her, but I could tell you some things that might have happened that might make you laugh on the other side of your face.
Well, come on, tell us a few. I bet my hair won't raise.
No, said Denham, smiling. You wouldn't believe them. Nor would I if someone just told me. Stories of ships coming in, docking, paying dues and checking papers, taking on stores and leaving again, and known and proved to be 3,000 miles away at the very time. That sort of yarn sounds very thin till it's happened to you. All I say is, I wouldn't believe anything was impossible at sea. Time and space aren't so solid as on shore.
All right. Well, when I see my first ghost, I'll come and tell you, and then you'll tell me all your horrors, and I'll believe them all.
As the Pride of Westminster steamed her way down the South Atlantic Ocean, towards the Cape of Good Hope, the weather grew worse. She was due at Cape Town by the second week in September, and by the first week she was in really heavy weather. But her engines were good, and though she made little speed, she was getting along steadily. Life on board was very uncomfortable in the heavy seas. The men were hardly ever out of their sou'westers and sea boots, and work was doubled with the need for constant care and inspection of ship and engines under the strain of prolonged battering by wind and sea. Captain Johnson was sitting at his cabin desk during a brief period of relief from the bridge. It was a dirty evening, and the Pride was rolling along in high seas. The captain listened to the steady beat of the engine's throb, and he muttered to himself, All well so far. So long as MacDonald keeps the engines going okay, we'll make it. I'd give a lot for a comfortable bed and a decent sleep for once, though.
He got up and went to a cupboard in the corner, measured out half a tumbler of rum and drank it, quickly locking the cupboard again.
Captain Johnson was very careful not to let anyone on board know of his secret habits. As he locked the door, he listened again to the engines, frowning faintly.
If we're any later than September 30th, he muttered, I'm done.
The calendar on his desk said September 5th, and he reckoned that they had a good 3 weeks still to go before they reached Mozambique. He unlocked a drawer in his desk and drew out a small, heavy steel box. Listening a moment for footsteps, he unlocked the box and half opened it, keeping the box in the drawer. His eyes glistened. On a pad of velvet lay 3 huge pearls. One a dark greenish, livid hue. They were obviously gems of infinite value, and not the sort of possession common to ordinary captains of small ships in an obscure line. Captain Johnson knew that they had been stolen. He had been given them at Deptford, with instructions to deliver them by September the 30th to a Dutchman in Mozambique. The man would wait in a certain cafe on the harbour quay every night till September 30th, and £3,000 would be handed to Captain Johnson on delivery of the three pearls. By these means, he had been able to gamble and drink heavily for several years, unknown to his wife and friends. Money was Captain Johnson's constant thought, for he was usually in debt and spent huge sums on gambling. There was nothing to which he would not stoop for money, and in one port on the West African coast, it was suspected that he had a man's blood on his hands. He locked the pearls away and turned to his logbook. Would the Pride get there in time? Could not MacDonald get any more speed out of this old boat? MacDonald was in the engine room, dressed in a stained boiler suit, capless, his face smeared with oil and sweat. His engines were running at full power, true and sweetly, and he had no intention of forcing them to a greater speed in spite of the captain's hints. Even in the brightly lit, hot, roaring engine room, it seemed to him that the weather was getting worse. It was time for him to knock off work, but was lingering down there when Denham put his head round the door above the steep ladder and called him.
"I say, Chief."
"Yeah?"
"You got a minute?"
MacDonald was surprised. He swung up the ladder and joined Denham in the passage. The second mate was in oilskins and dripping water.
"What's up?"
"Wireless has carried away. Weather's getting very bad."
"Well, we can use the spare if we need it. Batteries will be okay."
"Oh, yeah, that's all right."
"Well, what's up?"
"Got time to come down on deck for a moment?"
"This weather? Good heavens, man, why?"
"Well, there's something queer going on."
"I may have imagined it. I'd like you to have a look."
"Yes, certainly. I'll get my oilskin. Carry on."
The two of them scrambled along the pitching passage, up the companionway, and forced open the door onto the deck. They were nearly flung on their backs by the force of the gale as they stepped out, and had to slam the door to keep out the huge sea that drenched them both. MacDonald was just beginning to curse Denham for bringing him out, when the words dried on his lips.
"What's that?"
he gasped, pointing with his free hand over the wild sea. Denham shouted in his ear as the wind carried his voice away.
"That's what I wanted you to see!"
Level with the Pride on her port side, about half a mile away, was apparently a high-decked, three-masted sailing ship under full sail. Sometimes she plunged out of sight in the trough of great waves, but she rose heavily each time. Even if any sailing ship could have lived in such weather, this one was carrying an amount of sail which should have overset her long ago, or should have been ripped off by the gale.
"It's not possible," said MacDonald. "What is it? She'll go down in a moment."
"I don't think so,"
answered Denham queerly. MacDonald was still staring at her, but he looked at Denham, and a sudden thought sprang into his mind.
"Why not?"
he said sharply.
"Because she's been doing this for 300 years. All weathers, full sail set. She's the Flying Dutchman."
MacDonald could not answer. The scene was too convincing. No earthly ship could sail under that canvas in this gale. An uncanny chill gripped him.
File 4.
As they gazed, the Amsterdammer, called by seamen the Flying Dutchman as the story grew about her during the centuries, drew nearer to the pride of Westminster. A faint, luminous aura seemed to be surrounding her, and even in the swiftly falling gloom, the two men could see her clearly. The officer on the bridge had seen her now, and sent a message down to the captain that there was a very strange sight on the port bow. One or two men heard the rumour, and soon a large number of the crew were huddled on deck, peering with incredulous eyes at the labouring sailing ship. No one guessed who she was until Ferguson appeared. Now she was the only clearly visible object in the gathering night. Her high poop and forecastle, her three masts set in the deep well of her main deck, the heavy antique rigging and squat build of the hull were plain to every man. She was like no ship that any of them had ever seen. Ferguson took a long look at her and cried, "It's the Flying Dutchman! Lord have mercy on us all!" Horror seized every heart. Hard-bitten seamen though the whole crew were. The captain began to bluster and order the men below, but he fell silent, for the Flying Dutchman was seen to be approaching at a steady speed over the boiling sea. Ferguson pulled a small flat Bible out of an inner pocket. The Flying Dutchman was now within hail, but for the shriek of the wind. Her faint, ghostly glow had increased, and showed up every detail. The men on her decks were clearly distinguishable in archaic clothes, struggling with the ship's tackle. On the poop bridge was a small group of men, and one standing apart, a heavy figure in a fur cap and long coat and breeches. The watchers on the Pride of Westminster saw to their amazement that a boat was being lowered from the phantom ship. Although violently tossed by the waves, the boat managed to ride them, and two men began to row towards the Pride. Although the Pride did not slacken speed, the Flying Dutchman kept pace, and the rowing boat gained steadily on the steamer.
"Ahoy there!" shouted a voice,
and in spite of the gale the sound was very clear to every man on board.
"Throw us a rope, will you?"
"Don't move," said Captain Johnson hoarsely.
"Why not?" said Ferguson bluntly. "Those who've got good consciences have nothing to fear. Anyway, there'll be no need."
The crew had no time to be surprised at the cook's daring to speak to the captain like this, for the next moment his words were proved right. The man from the rowing boat appeared in the gloom over the rail of the Pride carrying a leather bag. He was bearded and scarred, wearing a cloth around his head and gold earrings, a tattered fur jacket and breeches rolled up to his knee. His feet were bare, and he lacked two fingers of one hand. Except for a greyness of hue, which seemed to make his flesh and all his clothes all one colour and texture, he appeared an ordinary human being.
"Why don't you throw us a rope?" he said. "We only want letters taken home. We have been beating about this cape for so long, and no news sent home. Our wives will think we are lost. Lost!"
His voice rose to a half shriek. The crew of the Pride shivered and stood silent. Denham spoke first. "How long have you been at sea?" The man began to answer.
"Months and months. Since.
And his voice faltered. He looked around him helplessly and seemed unable to go on. Instead, he advanced to the men, holding out his bag, and said,
"Will you take our letters? We must get word to our people."
He was approaching the captain, whose eyes were fixed on him in an almost hypnotized horror, and who stretched out his hand like a sleepwalker to take the bag. Ferguson, holding the Bible, stepped forward sharply before the bag was touched and said,
"We'll take no letters of yours."
The man did not try to insist,
but dropped the bag and burst into tears, wringing his hands and crying bitterly.
"No one will stop and help us. No one will take our letters. We have hailed many ships and asked them to befriend us and carry letters home to Antwerp, and not one has done so. One might think we were accursed."
Again his voice became a shriek that mingled with the gale and seemed to whirl around the ears of the listeners and be carried into the sky.
"So long, so long," wailed the ghostly seaman. "No sight of land, no sight of home. Oh, if we might make Antwerp once again, I'd never set foot aboard again if I might see the harbour church and the sun in on the Van Steyn quay. I'd never leave my home if I might see my wife and my little ones again."
"You would not know Antwerp harbour now. The church would not be there, nor the sun in, for I know the harbour well, and there is no Van Steyn quay there any more," said Ferguson. The man wept again.
"We have heard strange tales of this from other ships," he said, "but it cannot be true. We have only been at sea a year or so."
"I have seen a plan of Antwerp harbour of 200 years ago that did not show your Van Steyn quay," replied Ferguson. "You'd be a stranger there as you would in your own home, where your wife and children would have been dead and buried these 300 years.
"Oh, that I were dead and buried and at peace also," wept the man. "Our mate was lost overboard when this gale began, and he has escaped this torment. Oh, that the gale might abate a little. We could get round the cape soon enough in any weather. But this... Our captain is a good seaman, but no ship can make head against this gale. Well, friends, I'll leave our letters with you in hopes that you'll change your mind and help us."
With that, he took some letters from the bag and laid them on the deck, turned and disappeared over the rail. In a moment, the little boat, also lit by a ghostly glow, was seen moving back to the Flying Dutchman, with two men pulling at the oars. They climbed on board, and the boat was hoisted, and the next moment, the whole ship, in her luminous circle of faint light, had vanished into the blackness of the night. The men on the Pride of Westminster peered into the storm, but there was nothing to be seen beyond the pale sheen of their own porthole lights on the breaking foam of the waves. The letters lay on the deck as proof that they had not all been dreaming. The captain stared at them as in a trance, and then the wind seized them, swirled them up in a dance in the air, beating them about the heads of the crew, and carried them off up into the gale, where they were lost to sight. As the men returned silently to work, MacDonald caught Denham's arm and said,
"Do you think we shall all be lost because of her?"
Denham hesitated. "No, not necessarily. But I'm sure we shall never get the ship to port." That night the storm grew worse. There was no sleep for anyone. Mountains of water battered the decks and the hatches of the Pride, and it seemed that every thundering crash must smash her to pieces. MacDonald kept the engines at full power, but even so, she could not hold her course. The men were uneasy and half-hearted, and the captain did nothing to help. He went about silent and seemed to be still in the days in which he had stood on the deck before the ghostly mariner. The first shock of disaster came at 2 a.m. The port boat was torn from its davits by a huge sea and hurled onto the deck. The crash was followed almost at once by a worse alarm. Before the boat could be carried overboard, it was dashed with such fury into the engine room hatch that the hatch gave way and a torrent of water poured in. Instantly, the men rushed to block the gap with emergency repairs, but before they succeeded, two more great seas had swept the deck and flooded into the engine room. Clouds of steam arose and half blinded the men. Wading through the water, which was now halfway up to his knees, MacDonald saw a film of oil creeping over the surface. His eyes went to the pressure gauge, and to his dismay, saw the dial hand slowly moving over backwards.
"Losing pressure on the starboard engine," he muttered,
and a man shouted, "Main feed pipe gone here, sir!" He waded over to the pipe and saw that the icy seawater had cracked the heated metal in a dozen places, beyond hope of repair. Oil was streaming from it.
"Shut off the oil floor,"
ordered MacDonald, and the starboard engine died away. There was no hope now of keeping the course or making any way. The Pride could only struggle to keep her head into the storm and save herself from being swept broadside on by the weight of the seas. The wireless operator was sending out urgent appeals for help. With her hatch only roughly repaired and her engines crippled, the Pride was in a desperate plight. As she shuddered under the violence of the waves, righting herself after each with difficulty, it seemed likely that any help would be too late. The ship rose more slowly now from the trough of the rollers, so that any weight of water lay longer on her, and Denham wondered if the hull would stand the strain. The distress signals on the air were picked up by various ships, but the smaller ones were in no state themselves to come miles out of their course to give help. At last came better news. The Southern Cross passenger liner, Durban Cross, of 50,000 tons, on the Southern Cross route to the Cape, picked up the message and turned out of her way to find the Pride. Through the long hours of the night, the Pride laboured, reporting her position to the Durban Cross. She was leaking badly now, and the men were working the pumps in shifts. It was grey early morning when the watch reported that the liner was in sight. By now the Pride was taking so much water that it was clear she must be abandoned. All her boats were swept away, and the sea was too wild for even the larger boats of the Durban Cross to be launched. After the Pride had signalled her condition to the rescue ship, the liner answered that she would fire lifeline rockets over the Pride and take the crew off that way. Even so, the men wondered if the rescue would be in time. It was an hour of desperate struggle before the line could be secured, and the Pride was sinking under their feet. The men were ordered on deck and lined up, and one by one they were carried across to safety. Ferguson and Captain Johnson went last. In the captain's pocket lay his little steel box. Ferguson shook hands with him and climbed into the rescue apparatus. He was swung out over the raging sea, nothing but two thin cables between him and destruction. On the liner's deck, eager hands helped him to safety, and the line travelled back to the captain. Ferguson could see the heavy list at which the ship lay. Suddenly a dull thud came from within the Pride.
"Boilers burst!"
exclaimed MacDonald. A cry of horror went up from the watchers. The Pride of Westminster, with the captain still on the deck, listed to port. The captain was flung off his feet and carried into the rush of water, now pouring over the deck. Another explosion followed, and volumes of steam went up. The ship's bow rose out of the water as she began to slide into the sea by the stern. In a few moments, the doomed ship and her captain had disappeared from sight. Only great circles of oil on the waves remained. The curse of Van der Decken and his Flying Dutchman had brought another good ship to her end. Still, as the phantom ship beats about the Cape, and will do so, as Van der Decken swore, till Judgment Day. Even in fair weather she labours in a ghostly storm, and her seamen know no rest and no relief. Even the ending of their miseries by drowning is forbidden, since Van der Decken has sworn to defeat the elements. Accursed herself, and carrying the curse of the sea to all who set eyes on her, the Flying Dutchman wanders, without hope of gaining harbour, and without reprieve. The End.